It's been a quiet week in Pittsburgh, my adopted hometown. The Pirates are above 500. The World Cup fever has raised the nation's sports temperature accordingly. And enough sunshine has broken through the clouds to allow zucchini buds and tiny tomatoes to appear on backyard garden plots. Pittsburgh may be our home, but for others it's a destination. Like for Emily and Jeff Karsten, who drove into town recently to catch a plane at our airport. The Karstens live in the Laurel Highlands near the quiet little town of Gallitzin, PA. To get to here, they had to drive south to State Highway 23 toward Crescent, then west on US 22 until finally Route 376 got them safely all the way out to the airport. Watch your speed, limit your toilet breaks. You can do the whole trip in about 2 hours. Gallitzin, as a town, is named after Prince Demetrius Gallitzin, a Russian aristocrat whose conversion from the Russian Orthodox Church to becoming a priest in the Roman Catholic Church led him to break with both his family and his homeland. The prince priest arrived in America in 1792, and he soon made his way west from Baltimore to Cambria County. And along the way, he earned the title the Apostle of the Alleghenies. Prince Gallitzin established a Catholic mission there in Cambria County, which is called the Basilica to St. Michael the Archangel. And it still exists today outside the little town that bears his name with pride. Emily and Jeff have lived near Gallitzin for most of their lives. It's a small town, population 1,756 by a recent census. Honestly, there's not much there in terms of business or industry, but tourists come by occasionally to see the famous railroad tunnels of Gallitzin. For their local news, they can read the Altoona Mirror, but for the real news, they gather at the drugstore outside of town. There by the cash register, the folks can hear the real scoop that's never recorded in the newspapers. Everyone likes hearing a little bit of gossip now and then. Now sure, these are all good Christian folks who believe in forgiveness. They just also like to know exactly what it is they're forgiving others for. Emily teaches U.S. history and civics at the local junior high school. Civics is one of those subjects that no matter how hard you try, the material is never very interesting. At some point, you simply have to give the kids a multiple choice test on the Federalist Papers, John Jay, the Articles of Confederation, and the Stamp Act of 1765. Emily's of the school and the mindset that her class should still memorize things. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the bands which have long connected them with another, we the people, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now, Emily tries to liven up the class with bits of historical trivia that would be of interest to a bunch of 11-year-old boys. So she tells them that John Quincy Adams used to swim naked in the Potomac River, that Thomas Jefferson was the first person ever to serve French fries in America, doing so at his home in Monticello, and that William Howard Taft was so fat they had to install an extra-large bathtub in the White House just for him. For Emily, history is the lens through which she looks at life. She'd say things like, well, marriage is like the Electoral College. It works okay if you don't think too much about it. But Emily had also always wanted to see the world beyond Gallitzin. And she told Jeff for years that they needed to travel overseas, which was why the two of them had driven those 2 hours to board a plane in Pittsburgh that would take them to another plane at JFK Airport and eventually deposit them all the way overseas in Africa. Now, truthfully, Jeff would have been just as happy to stay home in Gallitzin, or at least close to the Prince Gallitzin State Forest, where he worked. That expanse of 24,000 forested acres was all nestled on the shoreline of Glendale Lake. And Jeff was a botanist by training. He happened to specialize in the area of tree communication, which was a subject that invariably raised eyebrows whenever he tried to explain it to neighbors or park visitors. Jeff could stand on one of the forested ridges of the state park near the hiking trail, and he could tell how a cluster of poplars was doing, as well as know what those trees were telling the other cluster of trees nearby. Now, if the hikers were listening to Jeff give this bit of information and they began to look askance at one another, Jeff knew he should change the subject. But he also knew there was truth in the reality and science of tree communication. Back in the early 1980s, a chemist up in Washington State named David Rhodes was looking for evidence to prove that plants can actively defend themselves against insects. Rhodes studied two groups of willow trees, one group that was infected with caterpillars and another group that wasn't. He discovered that the trees that were under attack began deploying an unsavory chemical into their leaves to discourage the hungry bugs. But what surprised Rhodes was that the nearby stand of trees that were unaffected also adjusted their internal chemicals so that their leaves would be uninviting just in case the caterpillars wandered their way. The press got hold of Rhodes' work, and soon everyone was writing about how trees talk to one another, which made a big splash until another famous scientist came along and claimed that Rhodes' studies were all poorly designed, you couldn't verify the data, and it simply wasn't true. And at that point, Rhodes couldn't get funding anymore for his work. And so, truth be told, he quit science altogether and opened a bed and breakfast. And the whole subject of plant communication actually fell dormant for years. But there were a few scientists like Jeff who refused to give up on Rhodes' research. There was a botanist who found out that sagebrush can produce high doses of a chemical compound, methyl jasminate, that is airborne and is effective in chasing away insect pests. And when the damaged sagebrush happens to grow near other plants, those neighboring plants also produce chemical inhibitors to scare away hungry caterpillars. It turns out that almost every green plant that's been studied has been found to release its own cocktail of chemicals which nearby plants can sense and respond to. So lima beans being eaten by beetles set forth a chemical that warns other lima beans that they better grow fast and grow strong to resist attack. When corn plants are damaged, they send out signals to the young seedlings nearby to prepare for an attack of armyworms. And even that fresh smell of cut grass that you enjoy when mowing the lawn is actually a blend of chemicals pleasant to us, but which signals to other plants nearby that there is danger afoot. So Jeff was happy to stay near Gallitzin and to spend his days walking through the dense forest of his own state park, to imagine how the roots and the branches and the chemicals of God's botanical creation were all interacting on a daily basis. And Emily, too, in her own way, was content to teach her classes of pre-teenagers about the roots of democracy, about the interconnected branches of the U.S. government, and about the crazy chemistry of modern politics. But both Jeff and Emily had reached a point in their lives where they needed a different perspective, a broader view on life than what was available to them there in the Laurel Highlands. Jeff and Emily's planes eventually deposited them both in Nairobi, Kenya, where a tour bus took them quickly through the busy city and out on a dusty road to the game park of Samburu. Jeff, as he looked out the windows of the bus, was fascinated by the plant life that he saw beside the roads, the acacia groves, the thorny desert scrub brush, the massive baobab trees. Where Emily, for her part, loved watching the people, the children running barefoot through the marketplace, the women with their colorful fabric skirts, the melodious vowels of Swahili and the heavily accented English used by the people spoken around them. When the couple had a brief stop finally at their lodge, they had a chance to quickly unpack their suitcases and splash some water on their faces before they were loaded into Land Rovers and sent out for a sunset drive in the game park. Like true tourists, they were excited when they saw their first baboons and their first vervet monkeys up close. But in truth, the novelty of these pesky primates soon wore off. They enjoyed the bright plumage of the kingfishers, the bee-eaters, the lilac-crested rollers, as they flashed their feathers across the deep African sky. But it was at the later part of the day, when the jeep slowly crested a ridge that overlooked a wide valley near a watering hole, that Emily and Jeff saw a view that took their breath away. Now, they had seen African animals before. They'd both been to the Pittsburgh Zoo. But here, the animals were all together in one giant mixed herd. Impalas with their curved horns and skittish tails, warthogs snuffling through the grass and dust, zebras flicking their tails, ostriches and cranes walking around the perimeter, wildebeests with their permanently furrowed brows and thick, angry necks, giraffes elegant in their stride as their long necks would place their mouths precisely at the right height to get the new leaves off the wide branches of the savanna trees. And there off to one side, a lone bull elephant with mismatched tucks, who was making his way slowly to drink from the sky-reflecting waters nearby. Having been so long accustomed to seeing all these animals in their separate and neat zoo enclosures, it was striking to see them all together in all their diversity. And of course, it suddenly made sense. Of course, the animals lived together. The large animals eating grass with hooves that would be large enough to stir up the insects for the birds and the smaller creatures. And in that group, whenever one of them was startled, whenever one of them snorted, whenever one of them took off running, they all took note. They all were alerted. They all were warned. In many ways, that form of life together was no different from the communication of the trees that Jeff studied. And it was a fresh way of understanding the messy interconnections of human life that are captured between the lines in Emily's history books. As he looked over that valley, and as the sun slowly set, Jeff called to mind a few lines from a famous foreign aristocrat. And this time, not Prince Gallitzin, but instead the Baroness, Isaac Dennison, who wrote the book Out of Africa. When Dennis Finch Hatton took the Baroness up in the airplane for the very first time, she says she saw this as an incredible gift, a glimpse of the world through God's eyes. And she thought, yes, I see. This is the way it was meant to be. Our vision of life too often focuses on the things that keep us distinct from one another. How we exist clustered together in family units, city regions, nations bounded by invisible borders. But our vision is not God's vision. Jeff remembered the old words from the Apostle Paul. The body is not made of one member, but of many. Because a foot is not a hand, that does not make it any less a part of the body. Because the ear is not an eye, does not make it any less a part of the whole body. And if one member suffers, then all suffer. And if one is honored, then all rejoice together." And as they parked there and looked over the valley, Jeff also remembered a prayer written by William Penn, who said, "A horizon is nothing except the limit of our sight. So lift us up, strong Son of God, that we may see further and see Thee more clearly." As the sun slowly set and the animals milled around the water hole in that African savanna, Jeff and Emily were silent. But a mind once expanded never returns back to its former size. And a heart of faith, enlarged by grace and visions of God's diversity, never shrinks back to its old provincial borders. The interconnections of life are at the heart of the God-given miracle of life. They are what make us more than the individual trees in a forest, more than the individuals making their way through the pages of history. It is the interconnections that we cherish, and more importantly, the interconnections we protect for all God's children and for all God's creatures, that makes us fully human and fully alive. It is then that we glimpse the world through God's eyes. And yes, it's then that we see this is the way it was meant to be. And that's the news from Pittsburgh, where all the women are strong, where all the men are good-looking, and all the Presbyterians are above average. Amen.